Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, May 14th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled Celebrate CB. It's just tradition. Judge says parade has community coming together. It's written by Andrew Smith of the Daily Nonpareil. After a week chock full of community events, families, friends, and neighbors gathered along Pearl and Main Streets Saturday as local businesses, schools, and organizations paraded through downtown Council Bluffs. At the parade's start, float competition judges showed off the handmade Golden Squirrel Trophy to be awarded to the students of Wilson Middle School for their float, which captured first place in the school category for the third straight year. Bill Wiggy, the head judge who helped run the parade for 12 years and has judged for 15 years, said that he appreciates the annual Celebrate CB parade as something in common for everyone to enjoy. "My favorite part is the community coming together," Wiggy said. "Great turnout. Obviously this year the weather helps." A few methods are used to help judge the groups each year. In the 2024 parade, but judges had to narrow down their top picks of 71 participating groups under the categories of light commercial, heavy commercial, nonprofit, school, and cheer. "The big thing is the theme and how it relates to Council Bluffs, probably past, present, and future," Wiggy said. "The other thing is the uniformity. With the schools, there's certain knowledge that we ask them, that they help build the float, and if they understand the theme and make sure that kids are involved." Residents echoed Wiggy's sentiments as they sat together watching the parade. "I like how we stick together and try to help out others when needed," said Heather Medeiros, who has lived in Council Bluffs for most of her life. She tries to go to the parade most years, with this being the first she got to take her 7-month-old dog, Lily. "It's just tradition," Medeiros said. One tradition was not carried forward for this year's Celebrate CB Week. There was no carnival in Bayless Park. "They don't have the carnival this year. That's kind of disappointing," said 40-year-old Council Bluffs resident Jeff Brown. Brown said he's been to the parade with family almost every year, but despite the carnival's absence, his group was finding plenty to do after grabbing breakfast. "We're going to check out everything we can. Whatever we find, we're probably going to do," Brown said. At the kids' market, one of the several booths had homemade honey. Bellows Bees Honey by Aiden had honey for sale in 12-ounce bear and 16-ounce hive-shaped bottles for $8 and $10, respectively. With coaxing from his father, Paul, Aiden Bellows said that he enjoys the honey plain. "We just advertise mostly on Facebook," said Courtney Williams, organizer of the market. "It gives them a chance to learn entrepreneurship skills and practice costs for suppliers and pricing. It's a great opportunity." After the parade, the Canesville Symphony Orchestra performed in the pavilion next to the fountain. To conclude Celebrate CB Week was mural painting and music in Cochrane Park down the First Avenue Trail that served as inspiration for the week's Oregon Trail video game theming. This year's scavenger's hunt was also modified to be more walkable, said Celebrate CB's coordinator Lindsay Grote-Rogers of the 712 Initiative. The 712 Initiative, now an arm of the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce, organized the parade with help from numerous partners, including Centris Credit Union as the presenting sponsor. The chamber assisted with the pancake feed. Food from other vendors and food trucks was available around the perimeter of the park. "I feel like this year we're getting to the point where this is really becoming that community event where the nonprofits are taking hold and being able to showcase what they do," Grote Rogers said. "We wanted to branch out and showcase the whole city, and the trail and the scavenger hunt is really kind of instrumental in doing that." In a related article, Murals and Music celebrates CB's art. Art creates a positive feeling. The good mood it fosters was evident Saturday in Cochrane Park as 8 area artists gathered to showcase their talents and personal feelings. Among the artists was Angelina Gutierrez of Omaha, whose painting celebrated the nice weather with bright colors for a positive impact, she said. "I'm creating what I feel like," Gutierrez said. There was also Avery Victor of Omaha, who was painting a girl reading a book with flowers and leaves in the background. "It's something fun and summery," Victor said. "It's symbolic of my getting back into reading. that inspired this. The artists took part in murals and music that celebrated four new murals along the First Avenue Trail and part of the week-long Celebrate CB lineup. "We're happy to showcase local talent," said spokesman Turner Morgan. "We're celebrating art today as well as continuing the community's art effort." As the artists were painting, the public had the chance to gain insight into their creative process and engage with them as they brought their visions to life. The scene was complemented by the live music of Andre Vandervelde, with food and ice cream concessions doing brisk business. "We're here to provide family-friendly programming," Turner said. Another artist who attended was Lauren Mankin of Omaha. Her painting was inspired by a recent photograph taken of her with her mother and grandmother. "I like to make things that are positive," she said. The artists who attended brought many years of experience. Richard Harrison, a 60-year-old Omaha resident, used bear marquee paint to create an eastern goldfinch, the state bird of Iowa. "Drawing and painting have been my favorite hobbies as long as I can remember," Harrison said. "I like nature and architecture." Harrison helped paint an actual grain silo last year. He is also involved with the South Omaha Mural Project, he said. "I've done art since I was 4 years old," said Victor, who earned a fine arts degree from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Victor was using acrylic paint for her mural. "It's easier to work with," Victor said. "It dries fast, so I can move on more quickly to other parts of the mural." Mankin has been painting since childhood, and she was using regular latex paint. Gutierrez noted that she has her first solo exhibition through May 31st in the Pet Shop Art Gallery in Omaha's Benson District. Morgan said the murals will be placed on large cubes in the park for the public to enjoy until they're moved to the Tom Hannafin River's Edge Park for Summerfest at River's Edge on Friday, June the 7th. "Public art is for everybody," Morgan said. "It promotes eternal positivity. We want people to feel optimistic about what is to come. That's what art is." And Celebrate CB Poster Contest Parade winners announced. The 712 Initiative announced winners from its Celebrate CB Poster Contest, as well as winners from Saturday's Celebrate CB Parade. The poster contest invited students at Wilson and Kern Middle Schools to create a poster detailing what they love about Council Bluffs. This year's overall Celebrate CB theme was the CB Trail. The poster contest received 33 submissions. Winners are as follows. Wilson Middle School, first place, Emmeline Polisipario Marquez, sixth grader. Second place, Ulysses Perez Ledesma, seventh grader. Third place, Jocelyn Smith, eighth grader. Kern Middle School, first place, Anna Johnson, eighth grader. Second place, Clarissa Kane Wilson, 8th grader, and 3rd place, Maggie Peterson, 7th grader. Honorable mentions. Students receiving honorable mentions include Eva Burgett, Sophie Roth, Sawyer Adams, Madison Beckman, Ellie Mosher, and Natalie Larson. The winning posters are expected to be featured in the inaugural edition of the Celebrate CB calendar in 2025. Certificates of recognition and artwork will be on display at PACE, fourth Friday event on Friday, May the 24th at the Hoff Family Arts and Culture Center. Wilson Middle School I Lead earned first place in the parade among school entries for the third year in a row. The cheer category saw Lewis Central Cheer take first and Abraham Lincoln Cheer take second. Council Bluffs Kennel Club napped first in the nonprofit category, with Pug Partners of Nebraska taking second. In the light commercial category, the Olive Branch took first, and Council Bluffs Dance Center took second, and Hanson House Assisted Living and Memory Care took third. American National Bank took first in heavy commercial, with CHI Health Mercy Council Bluffs taking second in that category. American Legion Post 2 Family took first in military entries. Next, Library Plans event to share public speaking tips. The Council Bluffs Public Library will be hosting The Art of Speaking on Thursday, May the 16th at 6:30 p.m. A panel of the Alternative Book Club members will present excerpts from their book, Spotlight on the Art of Speaking, offering tips and inspiration to all attendees, according to a news release. The program is free and open to the public, but it is intended for adults. The presentation aims to help authors appear trustworthy, competent, and likable when speaking to an audience to increase book sales. Presenters will discuss using humor, body language, and organization. The club aims to motivate each other for success. They published the first of 8 books in their Spotlight on the Art of series in September 2016, enabling personal growth through authorship. Next, Metro Crossing Jersey Mike's opens Wednesday. A new sandwich shop will open Wednesday in Council Bluffs Metro Crossing development. Jersey Mike's Subs will open at 3825 Denmark Drive, Suite 700, according to a news release. A grand opening fundraiser will run through Sunday, May 19th, to support the Council Bluffs School Foundation. Participation is limited to customers who receive a coupon as part of a grassroots campaign through the foundation. Team Council Bluffs is excited to enter a new neighborhood in our community in partnership with CBSF to provide fantastic quality food and help support a great cause, co-owner John Cotter said in the release. Bridget Watson, executive director of the Council Bluffs School Foundation, praised the new business, which is co-owned by Hanny Nacheff. Brittany Scott is the operating partner. The restaurant will offer delivery through its app and third-party delivery partners. Curbside pickup, in-store pickup, and a dining room are also offered. The shop's hours are 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. daily, and it can be reached at area code 712-796-3020. Authorities seek teen in alleged abuser's death. An Iowa teenage sex trafficking victim convicted of fatally stabbing a man whom she accused of abusing her has absconded from her probation, authorities said in court records. The Iowa Department of Corrections issued a nationwide warrant for the arrest of Piper Lewis this month after learning she had been removed from a treatment center in Atlanta and then failed to show up to probation meetings, the Associated Press reported. Lewis, age 19, had faced a 20-year prison sentence for the June 2020 fatal stabbing of Zachary Brooks. Lewis had said she was trafficked to Brooks, age 37, against her will and forced to have sex with him multiple times at age 15. Lewis pleaded guilty in September 2022 to involuntary manslaughter and willful injury and was sentenced to probation. After later admitting to violating the terms of her probation, a judge sentenced her again to probation but noted, "You've asked for a second chance, you don't get a third." Lewis was taken in November 2023 to a residential program in Atlanta that helps victims of sexual exploitation. She was accused of repeatedly violating the center's rules and asked to leave in March. The requested arrest warrant states, after that, she met with probation officials and was fitted with a GPS monitor, but failed to attend meetings and allowed the monitor battery to go dead, according to the requested warrant. Lewis's whereabouts haven't been known since April the 6th. Authorities seek tips in Hamburg bank robbery. Law enforcement in Hamburg are hoping someone spotted a motorcycle heading toward Missouri on Friday morning. Fremont County Sheriff Kevin Heistrope said in a news release Saturday that a robbery was reported Friday morning at about 10:08 a.m. at First Interstate Bank in Hamburg. A white man entered the bank minutes earlier and demanded money, the release stated. He left on a white Harley Davidson with a black saddlebags. The motorcycle was last seen southbound on Highway 275 near the Iowa-Missouri state line. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Fremont County Sheriff's Office at area code 712-374-2424. An Onawa man suspected of fatally shooting wife. An Onawa man has been arrested on suspicion of first-degree murder in connection with the shooting death of his wife. Jamie Allen, age 48, is accused of fatally shooting Stacy Allen, age 47, on Friday, according to a statement from the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. He was arrested at the scene without incident by deputies from the Monona County Sheriff's Office and booked into the Monona County Jail. Deputies were called to a residence in the 1900 block of Granite Street about 5:40 p.m. on Friday for a report of a shooting. Stacy Allen was located and pronounced deceased, the Omaha World Herald reported. Anawa is located alongside Interstate 29, about 62 miles north of Omaha. Anawa has approximately 2,900 residents and is the largest town on the Iowa side of the Missouri River between Council Bluffs and Sioux City. The homicide investigation is being conducted by the Division of Criminal Investigation with assistance from the Monona County Sheriff's Office. Now we come to a story entitled Feds Groups Sue to Block Immigration Law. It's written by Tom Barton of the Lee Gazette Des Moines Bureau. The U.S. Department of Justice and Iowa Civil Rights and Immigrant Rights Groups filed separate lawsuits last week to block enforcement of a new state law that would let state officials arrest and deport immigrants previously denied entry to the country. The groups intend to ask a federal court for a preliminary injunction to block the law from being enforced during the course of the litigation and prior to it taking effect. Set to take effect July 1st, the new law makes it a state crime for someone to attempt to enter Iowa after being previously deported or barred from entering the United States. The law makes it an aggravated misdemeanor, which carries up to a 2-year sentence. In some cases, including people with certain prior convictions, the state crime would become a felony punishable by up to 10 years in prison. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU of Iowa, and the American Immigration Council filed its lawsuit in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Iowa on behalf of Iowa Migrant Movement for Justice and the thousands of immigrants that the organization assists, including two anonymous immigrants. They argue the Iowa law conflicts with existing federal law and interferes with the federal government's authority to enforce immigration law. They also allege the state law would allow Iowa immigrants with legal status to be arrested and deported, going against immigration laws set by Congress. It is truly impossible to overstate how terrible this law is, how poorly written it is, how bizarre it is, and how extreme it is, ACLU of Iowa legal director Rita Bettis Austin said. The Justice Department announced it, too, had filed suit. The department sent a letter last week to top state officials warning it would sue to block the measure unless Iowa agrees to refrain from enforcing the new state law. The Constitution assigns the federal government to regulate immigration and manage our international borders, according to the Justice Department. Pursuant to this authority, Congress has established a comprehensive immigration framework governing the entry of non-citizens into the U.S. and the removal of non-citizens from the country. Because Senate File 2340 is preempted by federal law and violates the United States Constitution, the Justice Department seeks a declaration that SF 2340 is invalid and an order preliminarily or permanently enjoining the state from enforcing the law. Members of Iowa's Latino community, immigrant workers, advocates, and allies marched and held candlelight vigils last week in Iowa City, Davenport, Waterloo, and Des Moines to protest the law. Asucha Mi Voz, Iowa, an Iowa City-based immigrant advocacy group, in a statement ahead of the lawsuit's filing, praised efforts to block the law. The federal government and the local groups filing suits are right. Governor Reynolds's anti-immigration deportation law is unconstitutional, and we will continue to fight it in court and on the streets, Ninoska Campos said. The ACLU lawsuit names Republican Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd and two county attorneys as defendants. The attorneys would be tasked with enforcing the state law in the counties where the anonymous immigrants named as plaintiffs in the suit reside. Byrd, in a statement, said Iowa stands ready to defend our immigration law that keeps Iowa communities safe. When Democratic President Joe Biden fails to do his job and secure our borders, states have to take matters into their own hands, Byrd said. Iowa's law is not unique. It simply enforces immigration laws while Biden refuses to. Reynolds and other Republicans who supported the bill assert the law is needed because the federal government, in their view, has insufficiently enforced federal immigration laws and abdicated its duty to control the U.S.-Mexico border. As governor, I have a responsibility to protect the citizens of Iowa. Since President Biden refuses to enforce our nation's immigration laws, threatening the safety of our citizens, Iowa will step in, Reynolds said in a statement. The legal complaint states SF-2340 creates new crimes for anyone in Iowa, including a child who has re-entered the country after being deported, even if that person is now authorized to be in the country. The law states a court may not halt prosecution on the basis that a federal determination regarding the immigration status of the person is pending or will be initiated. As our two green card holder clients make clear, it would likewise apply to people who have been granted asylum or may have special visa given to them because they're survivors of domestic violence or other crimes, the ACLU's Austin said. The lawsuit highlights 18-year-old Anna, a pseudonym used in the lawsuit to protect her identity, who was born in Honduras where her father was murdered and her sister kidnapped. She fled to the United States with her mother in 2019 when she was 14 years old. They were deported in 2020. Shortly after, still fearing for their life, Anna re-entered the country again, this time unoccupied. She applied for and received asylum and is living in Iowa lawfully with an Iowa family and attending high school. But under SF-2340, she can be arrested and deported, the lawsuit states. The lawsuit also includes an Iowa immigrant referred to as Jane Doe, a 68-year-old widow, mother of five, and grandmother with health problems. She is currently a lawful permanent resident. A native of Mexico, she has lived in the United States for years. Doe, who lives in Garnavillo, was ordered removed in 2005 and then deported to Mexico, the suit states. Because her husband was a citizen, he applied for her to lawfully return. However, the application wasn't approved before his death. It wasn't until 2022 that she was able to return to Iowa. Even though she holds a green card, she has experienced anxiety and fear that she will be removed under SF-2340 and separated from her family. Another plaintiff, referred to as Elizabeth Rowe, age 40, a lawful permanent resident who lives in Des Moines with her husband. The suit states Rowe came to the United States in 2016 to reunite with her brothers, who are U.S. citizens. She was deported in 2017, married her U.S. citizen husband in 2018, and waited 5 years for her visa and inadmissibility waiver to be approved by the government. She lawfully re-entered in 2023. She worries that the life she has worked so hard to build here in Iowa will be shattered if she is prosecuted under SF-2340, the lawsuit states. Democrats, activists, and some police officials contend the law has serious logistical issues and will harm the relationship between law enforcement and immigrants. They say it dumps immigration law at the feet of local law enforcement, who say they don't have the tools or training to carry it out fairly. The law does not provide funding or a requirement to train officers on immigration law. Some law enforcement officials have said publicly the law will diminish public safety, not improve it, by making immigrants afraid to report crime and cooperate with police. It will create fear in our community that will make people reluctant to talk to police and to report crimes, Marshalltown Police Chief Michael Tupper said in a statement. Maria Corona, executive director of the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, said the law puts immigrant victims of domestic violence and sexual assault at risk. This law not only deters immigrant victims of intimate partner violence from calling police, but it penalizes victims already working with law enforcement to improve public safety by putting them at risk for arrest, deportation, or incarceration, Corona said. Discouraging domestic violence victims from calling police when they are in danger puts individuals at greater risk, undermines public safety, and threatens the well-being of communities across Iowa. The Iowa case is similar to Texas law that has been challenged by both the Justice Department and civil rights groups. The Texas law is temporarily blocked while a federal appeals court weighs a challenge to a lower court's ruling that struck it down. Now we turn to the opinion page, and we've got another view from the Chicago Tribune. and it's entitled, Will the DNC Really Be Live from Chicago? Democrats are nervous about the city and its mayor, who sympathizes with protesters. Chicago and the Democratic Party do not have identical agendas when it comes to the upcoming Democratic National Convention. Chicago's agenda as host city is to reap economic benefits from all the media attention and look like a desirable place in which to live, vacation, and do business. The Democratic Party's agenda is to ensure the re-election of President Joe Biden and boost the prospects of other Democratic candidates, especially those in tight races. Period. On the one hand, conventions are an opportunity. On the other, they present risks, especially this year. Democratic bosses know that most politically undecided Americans don't like the aggression and chaos on many American campuses from protests over the Israel-Hamas war, and they do not want to see the party or the president in the protesters' thrall. They also know that protesters have infiltrated many restricted places over the last several weeks, and the last thing they want is boos for Biden erupting inside the United Center, where it will look not so much like a Chicago problem as a Democratic Party problem. They've figured something else out, too. Chicago's activist mayor is sympathetic to the pro-Palestinian protesters and likes to refer to the police as an entity separate from himself rather than under his control. Thus, he cannot be counted on to protect the convention and the party's prospects. Some of those fears are articulated in a Politico article by Jonathan Martin, published Friday, that has the distinct aura of a deliberate trial balloon. Citing various sources, named and unnamed, including old Chicago hands such as Bill Daley, Martin suggests that the Democrats are in full-on risk mitigation mode and planning on holding as few live from Chicago events as they can get away with. The last convention in 2020 was, of course, a virtual affair by necessity, and some of those techniques, such as video cutaways to other locations, could be resurrected. Pre-recorded means risk-free. More specifically, the piece suggests that the Dems are seriously considering using a pre-taped delegation roll call from each state, as was the case in 2020. As Martin writes, that means one less opportunity for hot mic spontaneity and therefore disruption. This may well be, but for a party that likes to cloak itself in the importance of grassroots democracy, hot mic spontaneity is supposed to be something that is embraced, not feared. And if the nervous Nellies at the White House get their way, some of this might backfire. As for City Hall, it clearly needs to step up. Job one is to communicate that the mayor's activist proclivities notwithstanding, the Democrats have nothing to fear when it comes to security, and that the man who declares he speaks for the city will in August be on the side of the uninformed officers who work for him, not those who might set out to confound and disrupt. In a second opinion piece, written by Lisa Jarvis, who is a Bloomberg columnist and former executive editor of Chemical and Engineering News, would you get tested for an Alzheimer's gene? In a new paper in Nature Medicine, an international team of neurologists makes the compelling case that people with two copies of a gene called APOE4 aren't just at risk of Alzheimer's, they have a distinct form of the disease and are almost certain to develop its telltale brain plaques by age 65. The finding comes with caveats, but still has near-term implications for studying, diagnosing, and treating the disease, especially given the advent of drugs such as Leqembi, made by Eisai and Biogen, and donanemab, made by Eli Lilly and Company. It should motivate the field to push further into treatments that specifically target the protein encoded by this gene. It also raises a critical question for the public. Should more of us know whether we are carriers of these genes? Researchers have known for decades that people who harbor APOE4 have a higher risk of developing the neurological condition. One copy raises the chances of getting the disease as much as threefold, while two copies increases the risk by a factor of 10 or more. Many will recall movie star Chris Hemsworth's 2022 revelation that he carried two copies of the gene, news that reportedly prompted him to approach his life with a bit more intention. This new study puts a finer point on that risk. Using two data sets that encompass over 10,000 patients and over 3,000 brain donors, the researchers show that people with two copies of the gene will almost inevitably develop biological signs of the disease. Some 95% had buildup of a protein called amyloid, a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease, in their brain and spinal fluid by the time they are age 65. For that reason, the authors argue it should be considered a distinct genetic form of the disease. The data makes it tempting to consider these gene variants as causing the disease, but it's worth stopping short of that, for now at least. One big stumbling block is that while the study makes clear that nearly everyone in this group has amyloid plaque in their brains, we still can't predict when they'll develop symptoms such as confusion and forgetfulness, if at all. The most immediate impact could be on rethinking when and how to use approved and experimental drugs. This concrete evidence that Alzheimer's can be detected in the brain years before symptoms start is an incredible opportunity to try to intervene, said Raisa Sperling, an author on the study. The benefits could be significant. Some 2-3% of the population has two copies of APOE4, and it accounts for as many as 15% to 20% of the people with Alzheimer's. But intervening with existing drugs will be a bit tricky. Patients with two copies of the gene are more likely to experience dangerous brain swelling or bleeds if taking the drugs. And in clinical studies, Leqembi didn't do much to slow their cognitive decline, likely because so many amyloid had built up on their brains by the time they'd been treated. Sperling thinks it's worth using these drugs in this group of patients, but earlier, very carefully and ideally focused on prevention. The public will undoubtedly wonder whether this means they should go out and get tested for the gene. The question is one of deep debate. Without a treatment to disrupt the course of the disease, the results might simply cause anxiety. Yet people could make lifestyle changes, prepare for a future where they might need long-term care, or even seek out a clinical trial. It would be worth being more liberal in testing for people showing up at their doctor's offices with vague symptoms, even if they're young. And certainly, testing should become widespread if studies can untangle when and why the biological signs will lead to cognitive decline. It's also worth being hopeful. Drug development is advancing, and studies such as these could speed not only treatments for Alzheimer's, but ways to prevent it. And again, this was written by Lisa Jarvis, who is a Bloomberg columnist and former executive editor of Chemical and Engineering News. Now, a reminder that you're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments or concerns of this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now, we turn to today's obituaries, and we just have one in the Nonpareil. And we remember Jolene Fields, who passed away on May the 13th, 2024. Visitation Friday, May 17th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Funeral service Saturday, May 18th at 10:30 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Interment at Walnut Hill. Complete notice later. Next up is an article entitled Honey Creek MARC Today. Tornado relief services available at Mount Crescent. It's written by Scott Stewart of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. Officials are planning another multi-agency resource center opportunity for anyone recovering from tornadoes on April 26th and May 6th. The MARC is scheduled for 4 to 6 p.m. Tuesday at Mount Crescent Ski Area at 17026 Snow Hill Lane in Honey Creek, according to a news release. It is open to residents of Pottawatomie, Harrison, and Shelby counties. Available assistance at the MARC will include family store vouchers, emotional/spiritual care, rental and housing assistance, access to enroll in the Iowa Individual Assistance Grant and Disaster Case Advocacy Programs, unemployment assistance, resource referrals, food assistance, environmental and personal health safety information, recovery information, legal advice and representation, home repair assistance and referrals, and more, according to the release. Additional resources are available at established donation sites, which are Crescent City Hall, 102 West Florence Street, Neola Area Community Center at 110 4th Street, Trainer City Hall at 11 West Main Street, and Council Bluffs Resource Hub at 715 North 16th Street. The Council Bluffs site, organized by the Salvation Army, is open weekdays from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Pottawatomie County Emergency Management personnel joined colleagues from the state and federal levels to validate locally reported damage for tornadoes that took place May the 6th, and those findings have been reported to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the release states. Local officials are hopeful to hear positive results in the coming days, the release said. A presidential disaster declaration is being sought to open up FEMA and Small Business Administration assistance and loan programs. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation for Pottawatomie County and three other counties for the May 6th tornadoes. No injuries or major structural damages were reported. As recovery operations continue, county officials announced they are no longer seeking significant traffic at an established rural tree debris staging site, so they have moved it to appointment required availability. Call area code 712-328-5608 between 7 a.m. and 3:30 p.m. weekdays to schedule a drop-off. Appointments need at least a two-hour lead time on weekdays between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. Weekend appointments are also available. Do not be more than 30 minutes late to an appointment. The debris site is offering through May 24th, is offered through May 24th at the former KOA campground at 145th Street and Rosewood Road. Anyone looking to donate to support disaster survivors can contribute to the Southwest Iowa Emergency Fund or the Minden, Iowa Community Fund, both offered through the Community Foundation for Western Iowa. Go to givewesterniowa.org to contribute. The foundation's website also has information on how to apply for assistance from the funds, as well as links to relief resources and volunteer opportunities. Monetary donations of cash or check can also be made at Mid-States Bank in Neola or Minden. Write Minden Relief Fund in the memo line. Area nonprofits and businesses have been contributing to relief efforts as well, including a recent donation of meat by Tyson, distributed through New Visions Homeless Service to residents of Minden and the tornado-stricken Featherstone Apartments in Council Bluffs, as well as Minden area food pantries. New Visions CEO Brandy Waller said in news releases provided to the nonpareil that many families were without power for days and lost all the food in their refrigerators and freezers, if not all of their belongings. Tyson gave a literal truckload of meat to those affected by the disaster, the release stated. The New Visions team got some help from volunteers from Wellpoint and were able to serve 116 households from Featherstone in Council Bluffs and 108 households from Minden, providing food to a total number of 693 individuals who needed help. New Visions also helped pay for deposits and first month's rent for new housing for several families who were renting units struck by the tornadoes. Many of the families lost everything and need help rebuilding from the ground, including getting everything from a can opener to a shower curtain for their new homes, Waller said. Amidst the rubble and destruction, our team saw so much love, gratitude, and hope while serving our neighbors in need, and know Minden and other communities will come back stronger after this event, thanks to the community support. Pottawatomie GOP to host forum is the title of our next article. The Republican Party of Pottawatomie County will host a county candidate forum on Saturday, May the 18th, from 9 to 11 a.m. at Impact Hill, located at 501 Oakland Avenue in Oakland. This forum presents an opportunity for Pottawatomie County residents to engage directly with the candidates vying for positions on the Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors and the Pottawatomie County Auditor seat, according to a news release. With the primary approaching on Tuesday, June the 4th, voters will have the chance to gain insights into the perspectives, policies, and plans of those seeking leadership roles within the county. The event will feature candidates for the supervisor and auditor positions, the release states. All candidates on the primary ballot have been invited. The candidates for supervisor are Tim Wichman, who is an incumbent, Brian Shea, an incumbent, Charlie Johnson, Adam Hauser, and Karis Crilly. The candidates for auditor are Melvin Hauser, incumbent, and Marianne Hanusa. The forum is an opportunity for candidates to address questions on key issues impacting the county and why they are running for office, the release states. The aim is to provide an avenue for voters to better understand the visions and priorities of those seeking to represent them. Attendees will have the opportunity to submit their questions for consideration prior to the start of the forum, ensuring that key concerns from the community are addressed. The doors open at 8:30 a.m. and the event begins promptly at 9 a.m. Supervisor candidates will go first. The party said that members of the public are welcome to attend the candidate forum. We look forward to a constructive and informative forum as we collectively shape the future of Pottawatomie County at our primary election on Tuesday, June the 4th, the release states. DNR tries to keep river from going dry. This is written by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A rural Northwest Iowa water utility will be required to shut down its wells near the Ocheyedan River when its flow is very low, according to a permit recently issued by state regulators. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources has determined that several wells operated by the Osceola County Rural Water System have contributed to the river running dry near May City. That has happened 5 times in 8 years. The DNR put more restrictive conditions on the operation of the wells last year that did not prevent the river from drying out again in September. New conditions that were finalized in April are similar but use different triggers. Specifically, when stream flow in the area is less than 1/2 cubic feet per second, the wells must be idled. Previously, the wells were required to be shut down separately as their levels dropped. That 1/2 cubic feet per second seems pretty low, said Ed Jones, an Osceola County supervisor who lives near sometimes dry section of the river. Downstream from the area near Spencer, the river has been flowing at hundreds of cubic feet per second, according to U.S. Geological Survey data. The DNR did not immediately respond to requests to comment for this article. The water utility has opposed the restrictions, claiming that other factors are responsible. Indeed, the DNR determined that Osceola County was partly responsible for a 2022 dry up when it pumped water from a quarry near the river. That can reduce the amount of water in the ground and draw water from the river. But the county had not dewatered its quarry when another incident happened last year. The county has agreed to avoid pumping water from the quarry in July, August, and September when the river is typically at its lowest. The latest permit conditions for the water utility, which serves about 8,000 people and also sells water to a Minnesota utility, require it to photograph the river and document its pumping rates when one of the well levels drops to a certain elevation. The wells must be idled when the river flow is too low at the Verdon Avenue Bridge just northwest of May City. The special permit conditions are not effective if the river is dry upstream of the well fields, nor if the river is frozen. Osceola County Rural Water System did not respond to a comment request. Now it's time to turn to the sports page and let's take a look at what's on television in the sports world today. First, Major League Baseball at noon on the MLB Network. It's the Philadelphia Phillies at the New York Mets. 6:30 p.m. on TBS, New York Yankees at Minnesota. 9:30 p.m. on MLB Network. We got regional coverage, Colorado at San Diego, or Cincinnati at Arizona. In NBA basketball, we got at noon on ESPN2 is the NBA Draft Combine from Chicago. And at 7 p.m. on TNT, it's the Eastern Conference Semifinal, Indiana at New York. That's Game 5. And on True TV, it's also the Indiana versus New York Game 5 Eastern Conference Semifinal. At 9:30 p.m. on both TNT and True TV, it's the Western Conference Semifinal, Game 5, Minnesota at Denver. In the National Hockey League, at 6 p.m. on ESPN, we've got the Eastern Conference Semifinal, Game 5, Boston at Florida. At 8:30 p.m. on ESPN, it's the Western Conference Semifinal, Game 4, Vancouver at Edmonton. And in the WNBA, at 6:30 p.m. on ESPN2, it's Indiana at Connecticut. And at 9 p.m. on ESPN2, it's Phoenix at Las Vegas. Today's top local sports story is entitled Jepson's Journey Draws to a Close. Riverside Senior aims for 3 or 4 medals at state. It's written by Peter Burtnett of the Nonpareil. Grady Jepson has had a decorated career at Riverside. That career draws closer to its conclusion as the Bulldogs senior will race at the track and field state championships this week. On the gridiron, the Bulldogs quarterback led Riverside to a 4-win, 5-loss record this year, throwing for 1,439 yards, 16 touchdowns, and 5 interceptions on 118 out of 170 passing, while running for 650 yards and 11 touchdowns on the ground. He added 8 solo tackles and 3 interceptions, 1 returned for a pick 6 his senior season. Then, the excellent senior salute continued, perhaps even more impressively, on the hardwood. Jepson was named the Western Iowa Conference Player of the Year, averaging 25.5 points per game, ranking 10th in the state, and adding 7.3 rebounds, 3.7 assists, and 2 steals per game. Jepson also became Riverside's all-time leader in free throws in a career in a 36-point performance against St. Albert on February the 12th. He is committed to play basketball at the University of Sioux Falls next year. Going from the hardwood to the oval, Jepson has also excelled on the track this season, and he will have a chance to shine at state after winning 3 golds at the 1A state qualifying meet at Fremont Mills last Thursday. "It feels good," Jepson said. "Worked for it all year, early season training," and Coach Alex Oliver says, "great days in May. So 3 events, not too bad." The lone relay the Bulldogs missed out on, the 4x200, is one they used as motivation. "That's unfortunate. That's a race Riverside's successful at, good at," he said. "We were going to have a good time and had a little mishap, but at the end of the day, you got to bounce back. It's just one race, and it was motivational for the rest of us, for the rest of the night." The night got started on a strong 4x800 anchor leg by Jepson. Neck and neck with St. Albert through the first 3 legs, Jepson received the baton and created separation, winning by 25 seconds. "I got out quick, maybe a little too fast for the rest of the race, but the goal was just break them early," Jepson said. "Like, if you get out and fast and they see up there and might take a toll on them mentally, and that was the goal." At state, Jepson hopes to go out with a bang. "I've been there 3 times, 4 if you count alternate, my freshman year," he said. "I got a medal once and had been cut short of medal because there's some stuff in the races that we've mishapped. But it'd be great to go get 3 medals at state, maybe 4. Riverside qualified in the 4x100, 4x400, 4x800, and distance medley. The 4x800 will be held Thursday afternoon at 5:50 p.m., while each of the other 3 relays take place in the Friday afternoon session. The 4x100 and 4x400 are both the preliminary rounds, with the finals concluding the state tournament on Saturday. Jepson also plays baseball for the Bulldogs. He led Riverside with a .581 batting average, driving in a co-leading 15 RBIs, and was 0-3 on the mound in 17.2 innings pitched. Jepson's brother Cole, a freshman, also runs for the Bulldogs. In girls' high school soccer, Hauser's goal in 71st minute puts Trainer over St. Albert. This is written by Peter Burtnett of the Nonpareil, Dateline Trainer, Iowa. 10th-ranked Trainer scored with 10 minutes to play to defeat number 11 St. Albert 1-0 in a battle of ranked 1A teams on Friday. Hats off to St. Albert. They're phenomenal, Cardinals head coach Courtney Murphy said. Just two really good teams battling out. I just think our kids were willing to hang in there and kind of dogfight, scrap it out to the end. Cardinals senior captain Allie Hauser broke the deadlock in the 71st minute. We knew coming into this game that they're a pretty good team and we're going to fight, she said. We figured that was kind of how the game was going to go. It's just going to be a dogfight the whole time, and we played really hard. They played really hard. In the end, we're just the ones to pull through. In a game where Sophie Sheffield made several saves for the Saints, Hauser got the one to provide the difference. Soccer is just one play at a time kind of thing, Hauser said, and you got to stay in it the whole time, the whole game. Every single play matters, and that was just kind of what that was. It was just one play where I wanted the ball more than they did, and that's just what it came out to be. Lucky shot. The keeper was great tonight. She had some good saves, just not when I snuck it under. In a tense match throughout, the final touch would be the key to victory, Murphy added. I thought it was just the final touch and just continuing to pressure to the final whistle, Murphy said. From the first whistle to the last, I felt like the team that was able to do that was going to win. Both sporting a record of 13 wins and 2 losses coming into the match, the defenses dug in from the start. I know on our defensive line we have great speed, Hauser said. We work together great. We really work on connection in the back line. For them, I think they were pretty fast in the back. Hundreds work on through balls. And a lot of the times, you know, we weren't able to get to them before they could. It was just a dogfight all the way around. Trainer now heads into a postseason play opening against Logan Magnolia in the 1A6 first round on Wednesday at 7 p.m. with plenty of confidence after a ranked win. It gives us some confidence, Hauser said. You know, we played a good team today and we beat them. We know we can do that again. We're pretty sure we're going to see some good teams here in postseason, and we know we can fight like that, so we're just going to keep doing it. Murphy thought Trainer didn't even play their best. They still picked up confidence. We're just going to continue having really stingy defense, playing together as a team, and just play the Trainer way, Murphy added. Saints head coach Chris Hughes thought his team had more possession and just missed on the opportunities they had. We had some opportunities to put it in the net, and we didn't, Hughes said. And Trainer played good, but honestly, I thought we controlled the ball a lot of the time. Just, you know, sometimes soccer's a little cruel and it doesn't let you put it in the net. I thought the girls played well. The Saints wrapped up the regular season against defending state champion Bishop Heelan on Saturday, defeating the Crusaders for the first time since 1998 with a 3-3 win. Sophie Sheffield made 5 saves and regulation goals were scored by Ella Klusman, Sophia Denton, and Lily Crone. Klusman added an assist and scored in the shootout. Eleanor Coughlin, Kirsten Piskorski, and Olivia Gardner also scored penalties. And in high school boys soccer, Cardinals fly by Falcons in top 10 1A game. It's written by Austin Heinen. Class 1A number 7 Trainer left no doubt as they powered past Class 1A number 10 St. Albert 6-1 in Council Bluffs on Friday afternoon. After scoring 2 in the first half, Cardinals head coach Jason McIntosh spoke to his team about controlling the ball better. The team responded with 4 more goals in the second half to pull away. To come out and score early and often was fantastic, Cardinals coach Jason McIntosh said. St. Albert still out-possessed us in the first half with the ball, and I was a little disappointed in that, but we settled in at halftime and had a talk with the guys and definitely started playing some better soccer and got a great win to head into the postseason. The first goal came from Danny Kinsella off a corner kick piece. Tyson McCain scored goal number 2 late in the first half through a crowd to put the Cardinals up 2-0 at the break. McCain wasn't done yet as he scored early in the second half off a save deflection, and from that point on, the Cardinals kicked it up another gear. After having a discussion at halftime, we knew we needed to communicate more, McCain said. It was really important that everyone put in the effort and kept a strong mindset as we pushed through the game, and I think that helped us take things up a notch. Brock Poland later scored midway through the second half after dribbling the ball between a defender's legs before booting it in. Sawyer Goss later headed in the Card's fifth goal, followed by Jude Maieska to cap off Trainer's scoring. Aiden Keller also had three assists for the Cardinals. Maieska had two assists, while McCain, Nate White, and Andrew Keller all had one assist. With this being Trainer's final regular season contest, the Cardinals wanted to finish strong and make a statement. Brock Poland, among others, feels they did just that with this win. Coming into this game, we knew they were right behind us in the rankings, Poland said. We knew it was going to be challenging, but we came in with a must-win mentality and came in looking to prove a point that we were better than them, and I think that's exactly what we came in here and did. Danny Holtz would score late in the second half for the Falcons to deny the shutout. Trainer will wait for May 20th for a Class 1A semifinal game against the winner of West Central Valley versus PCM at 7 p.m. in Trainer. St. Albert will also wait to play again on May the 20th, where they will host either Underwood or Missouri Valley at 7 p.m. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.